It is Tuesday, March 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. In the next half hour, bomb attacks kill at least 30 people in the Belgian capital. We'll hear from a journalist who was at the scene of one of those attacks, the Brussels airport, and we'll hear from an American who was traveling on the city's subway system when the other attack happened. We'll also speak to two American Cuba watchers for their take on President Obama's visit to the island nation. It's all ahead on International Edition. Belgian police have released a photo of a wanted suspect in Tuesday's triple terror bombings that killed at least 30 people at the Brussels airport and a local subway station. The photograph taken from closed-circuit television shows a man wearing a black hat, a light-colored jacket, and sunglasses pushing an airport luggage cart alongside two other men who are believed to have been the suicide bombers at the airport. Authorities say the wanted man fled the scene. Belgian police also say they found a bomb, chemicals, and an Islamic State flag during a raid on a house in a Brussels neighborhood while searching for the suspect. The Islamic State group is claiming responsibility for Tuesday's horror. Earlier, I spoke to Nina De Vries, a freelance journalist who was at the Brussels airport at the time of the attack, waiting for a transit flight en route from West Africa to her home in Canada. I asked Nina what happened when the blast went off.
So I was up in one of the lounges. I decided to treat myself to staying in a lounge because I had a 5-hour wait before going from Brussels to Toronto. So that's where my final destination was. So, and I was just, doing internet and stuff. And I heard people screaming, or I heard some kind of commotion outside. And I thought it was kind of strange, but nobody seemed to really react. So I thought, okay, maybe it's just, somebody being, having a meltdown about something else. But then about 5 minutes later, somebody came in and said, oh, there's been a bomb threat. You need to leave the lounge right away. So what? I just basically followed everybody down. I took my little carry-on suitcase and just followed everybody down to gate 40. And everybody was just waiting there for about maybe 30 minutes. And I was asking what's going on. Nobody really seemed to know. I just kept hearing, there's been an explosion. And then I noticed some of the airline staff had started to cry. And that's when I kind of thought, oh, geez, something's really, it's probably really bad.
What's going through your mind at that time when you hear that an explosion has happened at an airport where, you're trying to get a flight?
Yeah, I was scared. I was very worried. Because we've had recent attacks in West Africa, the attacks last November in Paris. So, yeah, I was very scared. I was worried. I was following exactly what they told me to do. I noticed that a lot of people seemed actually quite relaxed. A lot of people were just sitting still by their gates. And that surprised me. I was very worried. I was very worried. Of course,
And what was the scene like as you left the airport and got eventually to your hotel?
Yeah, so basically they evacuated everybody outside, and for about a good 3 hours, everybody was just standing outside kind of waiting around. We didn't know what was happening. Nobody was really clear. Nobody really seemed to know. But people were pretty calm again. There wasn't a lot of, panic. Which was good, I think. People were calm under the circumstances. I myself, being a journalist, was chatting with people to see how they were feeling, and it was mixed feelings, of course. But overall, people were just glad they were safe. And buses came for us and brought us to this big sports arena. That's where they put everybody. And then they had sort of relief workers coming in, and they had water and sandwiches, little snacks and stuff for people. And yeah, people were just hanging out there for hours and hours. I'd say a good 5-6 hours. And then some airlines have put people up in hotels, such as myself. Brussels Air has put people up in hotels. I don't know if all the airlines have done that, but quite a few of them were doing that. So hopefully everybody's at least in a comfortable bed tonight. After
okay.
such a horrific incident.
Right, so. And I do hope you can basically continue on your journey soon. Thank you very much to freelance journalist Nina De Vries for speaking to VOA from near Brussels.
Thank you.
Well, Stephen Dow is an American author living in Brussels, and he was riding two trains behind the train that was bombed. He shares his story with my colleague, Susan Yaki.
I was actually running late this morning on my way into the center of Brussels, and I got on the train, and we went one stop. I got on at the Petion station, went one stop, and then the conductor stopped the train pretty abruptly, opened the doors, and told everyone to get out. He said we were supposed to get out of the train and leave the station immediately. And I asked him on the way out what had happened, and he said there had been an incident in a train, you know, two trains in front. But he looked really shaken. He didn't really want to give any more information than that.
Were people orderly when they got off of your train?
Yeah, completely. There was no panic. There was it was a very orderly situation. People were tense. And they were certainly aware of their surroundings to a degree that they probably were normally, but there was no panic at all.
Were people getting on their phones?
They were, completely. Everyone was on their phone, as a matter of fact, or either calling presumably loved ones or their offices, or just checking to find out what had been going on. We didn't really find out what had happened until probably 15 or 20 minutes later.
How did you find out?
I got a phone call from my wife. And then the people on I switched from the metro to a tram, and the people on the tram were talking about it as well. So
I'm sure your wife was very relieved to hear your voice.
She was. She was, yeah. I think everyone, as far as I know, everyone I know here is accounted for and safe. And I don't know of anyone who's lost anyone, so we're all very happy about that.
Had you sensed that there was tension in the air leading up to today? Was there any signs that something awful was going to happen?
You know, we've had troops on the streets here since the Paris bombings, and you never entirely get used to seeing them, but you. You know, I think a lot of us thought this was maybe a bit of an overreaction to the Paris bombings. And in truth, there's not a lot that troops on the streets are going to be able to do when someone wants to go in and blow themselves up. There's been a bit of tension, but it hasn't been particularly pronounced. And even this morning, after people found out what had happened at the airport, it was you know, people were aware, as I said, but it was calm. There isn't this sense of panic or anything like that.
Do you believe that the government's been doing all it can to help protect people from incidents like this?
Oh, I do. Yeah, absolutely. I think you know, as I say, they've had troops on the streets for months. They have been very communicative about what's happening, what's going on. You know, if anything, they've erred on the side of being overcautious.
Well, that was an American author speaking to my colleague, Susan Yaki, and his name is Stephen Dow. Well, it's time for our social media segment with G. Abby Lee, who joins me in the studio. G., where can we go to find the latest information about these Brussels attacks on social media?
Hi, Michael. So definitely the Brussels Airport Facebook page. It posts several times today in English and answers questions that are posed quite timely. The latest post begins like this. We express our deepest sympathy with victims and relatives. All flights and other operations at Brussels Airport have been cancelled for the day, and it added it's impossible to say when the operations will be resumed.
Well, that's understandable. What kind of comments were made on that post?
So one of the most liked comments reads like this. I know it's been said before, but it needs to be repeated. The terrorists who attacked Brussels today are the people the refugees are running away from. Their goal is to create a violent backlash against Muslims and divide the world even more. If we give in to fear and give up more of our freedom for the promise of security, the terrorists win. I know it's hard, but don't let them win. Love each other. Nearly 600 people liked the reply. And apart from supportive comments, the airport's Facebook page is also answering practical questions. Like one example is when and where to claim luggage left on the planes that didn't get to leave the airport.
Sure, a lot of people have those questions because it's one of the region's busiest airports. Well, what has the reaction to these attacks been like from the U.S. presidential hopefuls?
GOP frontrunner Donald Trump tweeted, This madness must be stopped, and I will stop it. He also took the time to take a jab at President Obama. He wrote, Obama and all others have been so weak and so politically correct that terror groups are forming and getting stronger. Shame. His Republican rival, Ted Cruz, had a similar response.
Okay, and what did the Democratic contenders say?
Both of the contenders cautioned against thinking one extremist group as representing a specific religion, and here's what Bernie Sanders wrote. It's important we not succumb to bigotry. We're fighting a terrorist organization killing innocent people. We're not fighting a religion. As you know, Bernie Sanders comes from that kind of background where his family had to flee Europe against Nazi rule. So
right.
he feels very strongly about it.
Uh-huh.
And Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton also wrote, these terrorists seek to undermine the democratic values that are the foundation of our way of life. They will never succeed. And signed it with a letter H indicating she wrote the tweet herself and not her staffer. Michael?
Great. Well, thanks for that wrap-up, G. You can find G on Twitter at GAbbyLee. And I'm on there as well at Michael_Lippin. We'd love to hear from you. You can also find the show on Twitter. Its handle is at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
There's no certain way to prevent dementia in individuals. We might be able to reduce the numbers of people, perhaps by 10, maybe 20, maybe even 30%.
That's Dr. Simon Ridley with Alzheimer's Research UK talking about a new study that concludes that exercise and healthful eating habits can dramatically decrease the risk of getting dementia. The conclusion seems like common sense to people on the streets of London.
It doesn't surprise me because I can even tell from a personal point of view that exercise and healthy eating makes me feel so much better.
If you get plenty of exercise and keep your mind active, that you know, you will sort of stave off dementia and Alzheimer's, things like that.
Some 45 million people worldwide are living with dementia, a number that is expected to nearly triple by 2050. There's no cure for it, but experts say that not smoking and staying active may help people to keep their minds healthy. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
I'm Michael Lippin with VOA's International Edition. U.S. President Barack Obama says it is time for the United States and Cuba to move beyond their Cold War differences. He was speaking on Tuesday in a televised address to the Cuban people hours before he departed the island nation at the end of a landmark three-day visit.
I have come here to bury the last remnant of the Cold War in the Americas. I have come here to extend the hand of friendship to the Cuban people. I want to be clear. The differences between our governments over these many years are real, and they are important. I'm sure President Castro would say the same thing. I know because I've heard him address those differences at length.
Well, Obama gave the speech at the El Gran Teatro de Havana, with Cuban President Raul Castro seated in a balcony directly across from him. The U.S. president used the opportunity to express hope for future relations between the United States and Cuba and their peoples. Well, the topic of Obama's visit to Cuba was the focus of our hashtag VOA television program, which was broadcast today and which I hosted along with Andrew Polchevsky. We had two guests in the studio with us. One was Larry Haas, a media commentator on international affairs and a senior fellow at the American Foreign Policy Council. We also had with us in the studio Luke Albee, a senior advisor at the Engage Cuba Coalition. He was also a former chief of staff for two U.S. senators. I asked Luke Albee to tell us why he was so looking forward to Obama's visit.
What I'm excited about and what we at Engage Cuba are excited about is we're watching history being made in real time. We have tried a policy of isolation for 55 years. And in our view, it's done very, very little to help the Cuban people. In fact, it's set back the Cuban people. It's done very, very little for the Cuban government other than to give them a reason why anything that does go wrong in Cuba is the fault of the United States. So I think President Obama has made a historic decision. This is a historic trip. And I think what's happening is he is speeding up the march of history. And there's going to come a day in the not too distant future when we're actually going to try a completely new policy of engagement.
When do you think that day is going to come?
You know, it depends. It depends. We're in Washington, D.C. right now, which is among the most dysfunctional places on earth these days. So you know, it's hard to get Congress to agree that the sun rises in the east and sets in the west. Having said that, there's actually broad bipartisan support, especially in the Senate, for changing policy, and we see it as our job to take our message out to the United States, where the majority of the American people support a change.
Well, Larry, you've been somewhat more skeptical about President Obama visiting Cuba. What do you think about what you've seen so far from Havana?
Well, I agree with Luke that it was definitely time for a change. I mean, we do engage with Democrats and autocrats all over the world, and we do it on a regular basis, and there's good reason for that. I think I'm mostly troubled by the fact that the president announced this change in late 2014, and he has pushed it along, restoring diplomatic relations, reopening the embassy, allowing for more commerce, allowing for more travel. And over the course of more than a year, during that time, he hasn't conditioned it on any change in behavior by the Castro regime. And in fact, in that time frame, the regime has cracked down harder on the dissidents in Cuba. We've had more arrests in recent months than we've had over the course of the last 5 or 6 years on a monthly basis. So we're not, in a sense, getting anything for it. We are not promoting our values of freedom and democracy, which, after all, we do think is a good thing, and we do think would be better for the Cuban people. And I think that the president is providing legitimacy for this political crackdown by visiting Cuba in the aftermath of more than a year of this vicious crackdown. And I think he should have conditioned his visit a little bit more on seeing progress up front rather than just hoping for it down the road.
And that was Larry Haas of the American Foreign Policy Council. You can hear more of that debate by watching the full show on our hashtag VOA Facebook page. This is VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This is VOA's International Edition. A new film tells the biographical story of a young girl who is struggling against a debilitating disease and is miraculously cured when she falls 10 meters from a tree limb. International Edition's David Byrd tells us about Miracles from Heaven, which stars Jennifer Garner as author and mom Christy Beam, whose daughter Annabelle was the subject of the film.
Christy Beam never wanted to be an author, especially with the story she had to tell. But her memoir, Miracles from Heaven, tells Christy's story of how she faced the painful sickness of her daughter Annabelle and how it was cured. Annabelle had pseudo-obstruction motility disorder, where the muscles in the intestines required to move the food misfire. People with the condition cannot adequately digest their food, often have to take several medications a day, and suffer from unending pain.
Mommy! I'm coming! Mommy!
When Anna got sick, I just couldn't understand it. Why was this loving little girl going through this?
I think your daughter is lactose intolerant.
Acid reflux.
Everything looks okay.
Everything's fine.
Everything is not fine. There's something wrong with our little girl.
Mrs. B, we need
some
to
more
calm
tests. I'm not leaving this hospital until I know what's wrong with my daughter.
All that changed on December 30th, 2011, when Annabelle fell 10 meters and was trapped inside a tree trunk. Once she was rescued, all Annabelle had was a slight concussion. She was taken to the hospital but suffered no ill effects of the fall. It was on the drive home from a night stay in the hospital where Annabelle told her mother of a trip to heaven. The young girl told of sitting on Jesus' lap and being told that she couldn't stay in heaven because there was work for her to do on earth. She was also told that when she got out of the tree, there would be nothing wrong with her. Over the next several months, Christy Beam says her daughter did not need her medicine as much and was eating and digesting her food normally. Gradually, and under her doctor's care, Annabelle was weaned from her medications until finally her disease was gone. Christy Beam's faith plays a big role in this film. Jennifer Garner, who plays Christy in the adaptation of the book by the same name, says that she was originally skeptical of the story until she met Christy and Annabelle.
Maybe I had a moment of cynicism about the story, but not once I met Christy, and certainly not once I met Annabelle. They're pretty special, and they're pretty frank, and I would believe anything Christy told me right at face value, and Annabelle, I wouldn't even ask her. She's a gem of a girl.
Garner, who last year went through a very public breakup with her ex-husband Ben Affleck, says that making miracles from heaven helped revive her own faith, something that she had let drift into the background.
This movie did bring faith back into the conversation of my life and did make me realize that my kids weren't going to get it just by osmosis, because my parents had given this to me, that I actually had to be intentional and to participate in it. I think I'd been lazy about it. So I got off my duff and we had a conversation and found a church that we liked and where we've been totally embraced and have been really happy.
Miracles from Heaven also stars Kylie Rogers as Annabelle Beam. Martin Henderson plays Christy's husband, Kevin Beam. Queen Latifah stars as Angela, a waitress who helps encourage the family on a hospital visit to Boston. Eugenio Derbez plays Dr. Samuel Nurko, who helps diagnose Annabelle's disease and oversees her care after she is cured. It is rated PG and distributed by Sony Pictures. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
And that's it for International Edition on the Voice of America. My thanks to director Tracy Cotter and engineer Daryl Smith. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Safe drinking water is fundamental to healthy lives and prosperous communities. To focus attention on the importance of clean water and to advocate for the sustainable management of freshwater resources, on March 22nd of every year, we observe International World Water Day. Every person needs at least 20 liters of water per day for drinking, cooking, sanitation, and hygiene needs alone. Yet some 2 billion people worldwide do not have access to safe drinking water, and more than 2.4 billion people do not have access to improved sanitation for adequate disposal of human waste. People who do not have access to clean water and sanitation are at greatly increased risk of infectious diseases, which can lead to physical and cognitive impairments and premature death. Contaminated water and poor sanitation are among the main causes of severe diarrheal diseases in the very young, the second leading cause of death in children under 5 years old. According to the World Health Organization, or WHO, some 760,000 young children die of diarrheal diseases across the world every year. It is further estimated that as few as 5 incidences of diarrhea in children under the age of 2 can lead to lifelong effects, such as developmental delays and stunting. Clearly, an adequate supply of safe water and access to basic sanitation are the most basic necessities of life. But the importance of clean water goes so much further than the assurance of hydration and cleanliness. This year's theme for the United Nations World Water Day is Better Water, Better Jobs. The slogan is meant to bring attention to the fact that nearly all jobs, regardless of the sector, depend directly on water. Cleaner water makes for a safer, more productive environment, results in healthier food, and contributes to a greener economy and sustainable development. But ensuring that people everywhere have access to all the clean water they need, where they need it, when they need it, reliably and sustainably, requires global cooperation. On this World Water Day, the United States remains steadfast in our commitment to achieving a water-secure future and we invite all stakeholders to partner with us to save water and save lives.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.